case, Walliser versus Mineta. Mr. Chase?
Good morning.
Morning.
May it please the court, I am John Walliser. I'm the appellant and I am pro se.
I read off the wrong card. Mr. Walliser, I'm Mr. Trey. You may proceed.
Thanks for the promotion. This morning, the defendants are asking this court to reject two very important Supreme Court decisions. The first was in the matter of Williamson County versus Hamilton Bank, where the Supreme Court established the rightness doctrine. And the second Supreme Court decision was in the matter of Zinnerman versus Birch, where the Supreme Court expanded upon its prior rulings in Hudson and Parrott, requiring the state to provide a pre-deprivation or a post-deprivation hearing in order to afford due process. Now, with regards to the rightness doctrine, it's a pretty easy doctrine to understand, and this circuit has faithfully followed that doctrine for over 17 years. Judge Cudahy, I believe that in Himmelstein, you stated that very clearly that before a litigant can come into a federal court complaining of a takings or due process violation, he must first seek inverse condemnation or equivalent relief in a state court proceeding and there be denied. That establishes the rightness to come into federal court. Now, this I did. I was denied in state court. The state Supreme Court refused certiorari in March of the year 2000. I came into the federal court complaining of a takings and due process violation, but the defendant successfully argued that the rightness doctrine should no longer apply. What should apply are the doctrines of Rooker-Feldman and res judicata. Now, the defendants have really offered no reasoned inquiry or substantial case law as to why the rightness doctrine should be rejected now by the court. All the defendants have done is that they've mischaracterized the nature of the state court proceedings, and they've mischaracterized the issues that I presented in this present action. Now, if the court does want to use Rooker-Feldman or res judicata to overcome the rightness doctrine, up until today, the court has always held those doctrines to be mutually exclusionary. You can't have them both at the same time. Nonetheless, that's what the defendants are asking you to do. Now, when the court looks very carefully at the issue of the takings without due process, what you'll see in this case is that my property was taken for a private rather than a public purpose. Today, there's another family that lives in the house that I designed and built with my own two hands. And that family will continue living in the house for a private purpose, even if someday this highway were to be built, because that property is not in any right-of-way for this project. Contrary to the representations that the defendants made to me, that my property was in a right-of-way and needed for construction, it wasn't. And at the same time that the defendants were making those representations to me in 1991, they were also in state court in eminent domain proceedings, claiming in their condemnation complaints that they had selected, located, and authorized the construction of this project. Now, that was years before the defendants ever did environmental studies, and it was in direct contradiction to the express authority that the General Assembly gave to the defendants. The General Assembly made it very clear to the defendants that they were only authorized to engage in studies and corridor preservation within the law. Now, that meant that the defendants first had to do environmental studies. Then they had to have a public hearing. After that, they had to generate a corridor preservation map, and they had to file that map with the county recorder showing the exact location of that corridor. Thereafter, under the statute, they were required to provide certified registered mail notice to every affected property owner. And if the defendants wanted to change the location of their corridor, they would have to repeat that process. Now, the defendants did not want to do this. They didn't comply with the statute or the General Assembly's authorizing legislation. And instead, they started acquiring property under the misrepresentation they had authorization for construction without doing environmental studies. Now, the defendants did this because at the same time, they were providing advanced knowledge of tollway interchange locations to connected developers in exchange for campaign contributions. Now, this unlawful corridor preservation agenda resulted in the deprivation of my use of my intended relocation site because the defendants went to local zoning boards instructing them to restrict building permits and zoning permits within their corridor. They unlawfully restricted development in a manner not provided for in the statute. Now, because of that, I could not use my intended relocation site. It was denied to me. So I sought relocation assistance and benefits. I was denied without reason. I sought a hearing, which is my right under the State Displaced Person Act. And in accordance with the initiation of negotiation letter that the defendants provided to me, assuring me of my right to judicial review in state and or federal court, I never received that right to a hearing. And instead, the defendants subjected me to a restrictive proceeding of forcible entry and detainer, a restrictive proceeding where it was ruled I could not raise violations of relocation or acquisition laws as a defense. Now, the defendants subjected me to this restrictive proceeding not once, but twice, and then they subjected my wife to the same restrictive proceeding, all in a span of 7 years. And during that 7-year period, they consistently acted to obstruct and deny to me my right to a relocation hearing. And that's because any relocation hearing would have brought out the fact that I was denied my intended relocation site because of their corrupt and unlawful corridor preservation scheme. Now, the Supreme Court made it pretty clear in Hudson, Parrott, and in Zinnerman what constituted a due process violation. Now, if their conduct had been random and unauthorized, due process required that they had to provide to me a post-deprivation tort remedy. This we have shown the defendants have failed to provide. Now, if the court wants to view their conduct as being authorized, a legitimate state action under the State's Forcible Entry and Detainer Act, then what the Supreme Court said was they were required to provide to me a pre-deprivation hearing.
What is the bottom line relief that you're asking from this state of Illinois?
From the state of Illinois, I am asking for damages for the taking of my property without due process of law. I'm asking for damages for denying to me my rights and entitlements as a displaced person. I'm asking that this project be enjoined because the defendants violated federal environmental laws.
How do you get around that Downers Grove National Bank versus Brown case, where the Illinois Appellate Court held that all of your claims raised in that 1999 state court action were barred by res judicata?
I don't get around that. I rely upon that. There were two.
What did your complaint allege in that case? It's any different?
In both of those cases, my complaint alleged that there had been a taking without due process of law. But in the first decision that the state set forth in the appellate court, they said I could not establish a takings claim because I still retained possession of the property and we'd be able to sell it. Now, when we proceeded with our second case before the state court, we presented a different scenario because my property was unsaleable. It had been sold and went into foreclosure. I no longer had possession of it. So we presented a different scenario to the state court in the second action, but the state court never reached those merits.
Well, what claims are you bringing in this lawsuit that you think that you couldn't have brought in the previous lawsuits?
Because my property now was made unsaleable. Nobody would buy it. It was foreclosed upon. I lost the use and enjoyment of it. Now, there's another distinction here. In those first state court rulings, they said I was not a displaced person because I had not yet moved. But in the second action, we show the court that I had been displaced, I had moved, but the court ruled it was res judicata. They never reached the merits. So I was prevented from presenting those issues to the court, and the court did not rule on those merits, and they should have.
Did you want to save some time as well?
Yes, 2 minutes if I could.
Sure.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Schmidt?
May it please the court, I'm John Schmidt on behalf of the State of Illinois defendants, Mr. Kukulich, the head of the State Toll Highway Authority, and Mr. Brown, who's the director of the Department of Transportation. I think our position's outlined in our brief. We believe that that the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine bars count one and res judicata bars all five of the counts of Mr. Wallace's complaint. Either because they were raised in prior actions or they could have been raised in those actions. And I believe Mr. Walliser is wrong in stating that the Downers Grove versus Brown case did not consider on the merits whether he was a displaced person. I believe the appellate court decision shows that the merits of that contention were reached and he lost. there have now been two federal court or two state court actions, and I'm not counting the original eviction action, and a prior federal court action where he either lost on the claims he presented or he had an opportunity to bring those claims. As to count three of his complaint, he was actually the founder of an organization that was a co-plaintiff with the Sierra Club, and they were successful on the environmental impact statement issue. So I don't see the point of bringing that up here. But and I believe res judicata still applies, even though they did happen to be successful. As to the individual counts themselves, in count one, he brings his claim for relocation benefits, and that was brought in the state actions. In count two, he claims that the state failed to follow the proper procedures in creating this corridor, that they failed to file something called the Corridor Protection Act. That could have been brought in the prior claims. And in his final state court action, he did bring a claim complaining of the procedures used in condemning the tollway land. Count three I've dealt with. Count five, the malicious use of process count, could have been litigated, and it appears that it was in the final state court action that was resolved with an appellate court decision. So we believe that res judicata does take care of every count of his current action. And to the extent he's bringing constitutional claims, most, we've also mentioned in our brief, would be barred by the statute of limitations for Section 1983 actions. And if there are no questions, I'll just ask that the dismissal order of the district court be affirmed by this court.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mr. Walliser. Mr. Walliser has two claims that he stated in his complaint against the federal government, one under the Uniform Relocation Act and one under the National Environmental Policy Act. The simple answer to the claim under the Uniform Relocation Act is that whatever his complaints there, they aren't against the federal government, because as this court held in the last time this case was before you, there aren't any federal funds supporting this project. And as to the claim under the National Environmental Policy Act, as Mr. Schmidt stated, Mr. Walliser was privy to a case which was which raised challenges to the environmental impact statement here, and in fact was successful, and a new environmental impact statement has actually just recently been completed. So if there are no further questions, we'd ask that the decision of the district court be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Hale. Ms. Walliser?
Thank you. First of all, with respect to res judicata, there were two state court actions basically here. One was an inverse condemnation, another was an eviction proceeding. Now, the eviction proceeding, limited statutory proceeding, subject matter jurisdiction. So anything the court wants to rule on regarding relocation assistance and benefits, it's a question of subject matter jurisdiction. There's a state statute, procedures are established, and that establishes jurisdiction. They acted without jurisdiction. I'm entitled to my right to a hearing according to law. Now, regarding the inverse condemnation, it's very clear I can't come into court until I first seek inverse condemnation and am denied. Now, I was denied in March of 2000. They want to say limitations. What are the limitations? 2 months? It's supposed to be 2 years. I came here within 6 months of the denial of relief in state court. That's a requirement for federal court jurisdiction, not a block to it. Now, regarding the federal causes of action, the federal government continues to misrepresent what the statute says. The statute says that the secretary shall not provide or grant to any sums of money that will be available, not that has been available. Under the statute, it's too late to give them money and then come in and complain that they haven't complied with their obligations under the statute. They have to be enforced before they provide the money, not after the money is provided. And with regards to the Environmental Protection Act, none of these issues could have been raised in any of the other earlier proceedings in the Sierra Club matter. They weren't at issue then. They did not exist then. So they're separate issues, separate laws, separate causes of action, separate facts.
Thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. The court will proceed to the fourth.